Jeff Collusion is a local contractor, father of 10, and also occasionally does violently rude and offensive cross-stitch to be sold to raise funds for orphans so that they can buy more hairnets. But Jeff is a contractor with a difference. Working with a highly trained team of diminutive Welshmen, a fleet of web-footed Peruvian women, and an alpaca named George, who was once highly favored by the Queen of Denmark before a terrible incident involving a lasagna and a group of anemic schoolchildren, Jeff designs and builds underwater villain lairs for the rich and powerful, who, due to a physical deformity and the fact that they've never felt the touch of an unpaid woman's hand lovingly on their shoulder, have decided to take up world domination. One such balmy monster is Dr. Vlad Clawface, who, as luck would have it, does have, partially at least, a claw for a face. Well, Jeff is a wizard. I mean, his steel-reinforced vault doors, his elevators filled with deadly nerve gas, and the way he delicately adds beautiful recessed lighting to our pool of rabid piranha, well, it's quite wunderbar. Another mad bastard with metallic elbows and knives in his boot, who wants to win an arms race because his mother denied his advances for affection, Professor Albert Colostomy says,
"When I first pictured an underwater lair populated by robot ninjas, a large, well-dressed Samoan man with a glove covered in glass and an escape hatch that, if utilized by anyone other than me or my spaniel Frederick, lasers your knees off, I thought, well, Albert, my lad, that's all very well, but where on earth are you going to find the competent craftsman to build it? Jeff's quote was professional, reasonable, and with very little padding or inflation, and his wife even threw in some discounted ninja outfits that she knitted and some homemade gluten-free organic treatettes for Frederick.
Jeff talks about how he got into the evil lair game.
Well, you know, like most contractors, I was used to working on cottages, some semi-detached roofing, the odd bungalow, nothing very fancy, you know. I knew in my heart, really, that I was destined for more. One day I got talking with this loony billionaire who wanted to put pressure-mounted spikes into a jacuzzi to do away with his wife's lover, Olaf. It got me thinking, is that even possible, and just how would one build it? After that, the jobs just started to roll in.
With the perfect combination of a dizzyingly rich top 1% and the panic and fear of nuclear annihilation due to the voting habits of people who have self-destructive knee-jerk responses to things that they don't understand, fascists and idiots, the world seems to be in the midst of a perfect storm for the likes of craftsmen like Jeff. With other rival companies offering volcano dwellings complete with booby-trapped helipads, tricked-out panic room basement command centers featuring the latest in satellite monitoring technologies, manned by computer hackers, hipsters in Hawaiian shirts who again have troubling histories with women, and even labyrinthine moon bases equipped with country obliterating cannons and the latest soda stream, it seems like there will be plenty of work to be had and money to be made in the years to come. But before the world falls completely off the brink into the pit of despair and disaster, here's the aftermovie dino, which, if we're honest, is hardly helping matters.
You're listening to the Aftermovie Diner with your host, John Cross.
That's right. I am John Cross, and I'm talking to you right now using some rather worrying lips. Hello, ladies, Burks, people who own entire subscriptions to Yachting Monthly, Basil Elderly, the minister for tossing his oar about, a fleet of huskies all named Harold, a potted plant that's grown into the shape of some genitals, I'm not telling you which or how many, a defrocked minister taking an upright bath outside at a family picnic rest area, the president of Paraguay, the president of Paraguay's horse, the president of Paraguay's horse's handler, Rupert, and some ducks called Ethel, who have just started their own Etsy business selling belly button lint sewn into necklaces for bored hippies and millennials with disposable income. Welcome one, and welcome all. This week's show is a very special one, as it is our episode for our 7th anniversary of podcasting, which should feel and sound way more momentous and important than it actually does. Not many in our game, though, are still going strong 7 years later, and certainly none have lost popularity, ability, interest, and engagement so spectacularly as us. For that, I thank you all. Some people on Facebook took time out of their day of posting pictures of their pets, arguing with their right-wing relatives and bitching about a Buffy reboot to comment. Here's what they had to say. Chris Leatherman says, "Congrats on your continued success." He surely doesn't know. Anyway, also, by chance, I was just scrolling through the old episodes list yesterday and picked out a few that I was planning to revisit at work this week. The Patriot, the Hoskins Double Bill, all of the Dola Eps, the Eliminators Vindicator episode, Blue Steel, and of course, and Salmonoid. And yes, all those episodes are available on the After Movie Diner, covering those weird and wonderful films. You should all check them out. Jim Wallace, our co-host on the After Movie Diner, said, "Happy birthday, man. Personally, I would like people to celebrate by buying you a cup of birthday coffee." That's right. Using this system called Ko-Fi at ko-fi.com, you can, what they call, buy us a coffee. And the link to do that is on our newsletter, if you subscribe to our newsletter, but it's also on our website, aftermoviediner.com. So sure, take a leaf out of Jim's book and go buy us a coffee. That would be fantastic. Robert Long from Baltimore. What up, my Baltimore peeps? It's been a while since I said that. Robert Long says, "Obviously, I'm partial to the Don Dola podcasts. What is also great is the passion and fun that John and his hosts bring to the program when they go over the films they have watched. Incredible stuff. Oh, and John's Michael Caine and Steven Seagal impressions. Love the show and cheers." Ricky Morgan says, "Awesome and congrats." And then Kimberly Taylor, my fiance, says, "I love what you do, how you do it, and I love being along for the ride." Well, I love you being along for the ride too, my darling. Thanks so much for saying that. Some people on Twitter finally stopped screaming obscenities at each other, arguing about the stupidity of a celebrity believing they should have freedom of speech in public, calling each other snowflakes and believing that their rants in 140 characters, or now more in fact, have any effect on anything happening in the world except to deaden all our souls and wish we could be shot into space at high velocity, and had actually some relatively positive things to say. Matt Farley of Moturn Media, or at Moturn Media, says, "Congrats, keep doing what you're doing." Poop Culture at Poop Culture says, "Damn, dude, 7 years, congrats." And then they said, "That's an amazing feat either way. No wonder your show is fantastic." Dr. Fuzz, people might also know him as Voodoo Fuzz, who writes some of the great After Movie Diner music that we have featured here on the show. He says, "I feel like you and Jim Wallace are two great friends. Life's been kind of shite over the last few years, but you guys have made me laugh." Well, we're always happy to make people laugh, especially at our ridiculous arguments, like we're a pair of old women. Now I'm going to get letters that, well, you know, that's gender bias. Old men complain as well. All right. Whatever. Fuck. Jesus. Lastly, I'd like to thank our Patreon supporters by name. The wonderful Micah Johnson, Michael Fitzgerald, thank you so much for donating this week. Chris Leatherman, Charles H. Nelson, Cole Reel, Peter Osmond, David Brighton, Judith Taylor, Chris Salt, Mark Burns, Hamble Wallace, and yes, the co-host of the show, Jim Wallace, supports his own show. That is just the kind of guy he is, putting his money where his mouth is. So a huge, huge, huge thank you to all those people for all their support over the last 7 years, or the last 7 days, depending on how long they've been supporters. But anyway, if you guys want to be like them, you can support the podcast over at patreon.com. That's patreon.com/aftermoviediner. And not only get some great rewards, but get the personal reward of knowing you paid it forward once. You can then smugly lord your goodness over all your friends at your next Fondle a Bishop while wearing a Sou'wester social. You can also go to aftermoviediner.com and click on the Amazon link in the top right-hand corner before you do your Amazon shopping. It costs you absolutely no extra, but everything you buy, Amazon kicks us a few shiny coins. You can also, of course, click that link and then bookmark that Amazon as your Amazon, and then that way, every time you do your shopping and click on your bookmark, you'll be helping the podcast out without, as I said, costing you any extra. You can also do the aforementioned buying us a coffee. There's a little button there on aftermoviediner.com. And finally, you can go to miskplumbingfixtures.bandcamp.com. That's M-I-S-C plumbingfixtures.bandcamp.com, and buy some singer-songwritery, folky, bluesy, rocky music by Miscellaneous Plumbing Fixtures. Every penny goes back to keeping aftermoviediner.com and this podcast alive. So please help us out where you can, and if you can't, at least rate and review us wherever the podcast is found, and help spread the word by sharing, liking, and commenting on social media. Sharing really does help. Retweeting really does help. Liking and commenting helps as well. So please, 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 whenever you see anything posted by After Movie Diner, just share it. Your family and friends might be interested too. Stop keeping it all to yourself. Anyway, that's enough of me rambling on. Let's head over to a diner where another anniversary is taking place. It's the 50th anniversary of the Beatles-based animation Yellow Submarine, and we're talking about it as it got a theatrical reissue. Enjoy the show. All right. Hello, ladies and germs, and welcome to this episode of the After Movie Diner. And despite the trials and tribulations...
And there were trials and there were tribulations.
There was, actually.
We ended up doing it again. We walked through stinky...
Thank you so much.
Can I get milk? Thank you very much.
Should we go through the trials and tribulations quickly?
Well, because we ended up walking, like, doing a stinky, stinky walk through stinky, smaggy...
Stinkville. Well, what happened was, quite simply, was this. This evening, we wanted to go and see the Beatles animation classic Yellow Submarine, which is on its
50th... I forgot.
On its 50th anniversary. And there were two cinemas, well, three, but one wasn't playing till 8 o'clock. So there was two cinemas we could go to. One which is right by my apartment, Williamsburg Cinemas, and the other one which was the downtown Brooklyn. Not near my apartment.
So guess which one I chose? Well, I chose to be as far away from your apartment as possible.
So we walked all... Well, we got the train...
Yeah, that bit was fun.
From Midtown...
The train was okay.
...to the Alamo Draft House. Now, for people who don't know, it's been... I'm ready, but he's still...
I'm sorry, I still need a little
couple
bit more
minutes.
Time.
Thank you. So, it had been horribly, horribly, horribly humid today. And
so
then
we just took the...
Huge...
We take the subway, go well, straight
and
to the...
And there was a huge storm... and downpour, so we were like, this is perfect. We'll take the Q train right from outside both our offices down to the Alamo Draft House.
Yes.
So we do that. Then we go up the three flights that it takes to get to the Alamo Draft House, which is in some sodding shopping mall in downtown Brooklyn. We get all the way to the top. We get right up to the desk. And he's like, sorry, mate, we've got two seats.
Only two seats left.
One was right down the front and one was all the way at the back. So we were like, well, keck this for a plate of soldiers.
And then I had an idea.
And then Jim said, well, we'll get back on the train and we'll go up to Williamsburg Cinemas because Yellow Submarine started at 7:15 and Skyscraper started at 7:30. So if we didn't make the 7:15, we could indeed go and see Dwayne The Rock Johnson chew his way through iron girders and leap ridiculously large gaps with a gammy leg.
Which I was looking forward to.
Which we would have gone to see had Yellow Submarine been either... A, sold out, or B, we'd missed the beginning of it. So we get to Williamsburg Cinemas after I completely missed our stop on the G, and we had to... I was mucking with the G, pal, and I had to...
He kept saying this.
I kept saying it.
And he kept saying it, even after I made it abundantly clear. I didn't know what he was talking about
it's from
or what
the,
he was referring
it's
to.
It's from The Untouchables. Yeah, Sean Connery says it in The Untouchables.
Well, I don't remember him saying it in Untouchables.
He says, you're mucking with the G, pal.
I do not remember this happening.
He says it in The Untouchables.
I'm sure it does.
Yeah, he does.
He just had a dream.
He generally...
I think you make up Untouchables quite.
I don't make...
That happened to vaguely fit with whatever scenario we're
it's
in.
It's not.
We're on the G train.
We're on the G
so
train.
So you get to say...
So you're mucking with the G,
also,
pal.
Also, we were... And this is... And listen, consider yourselves lucky here. Because kindly tell the listening several where it was we were going to eat if we'd gone to the Alamo Draft House.
Oh, if we'd gone to the Alamo Draft House, we would have eaten in Junior's.
And it would have been, he would have said that about nine times.
But I don't know whether that has been on the show. Was that single white female that I did Junior's
yes.
in? Or was it,
yes.
what was the...
No, it wasn't the one that we'd never...
The lost
episode.
Podcast.
Yeah.
The Bad Batch, which yeah. is the lost episode.
Well, you said those unforgivable things
no.
that meant that the podcast has to be buried forever.
There are literally two episodes out there floating around that I've not...
Yeah, that one? And well, you just got depressed during that one.
Baby, no, there's Baby Driver.
Baby
where
Driver,
I
we
got
both
depressed.
Got depressed.
And then Bad Batch, you and I had a big argument about drugs
yes,
and movies.
Yes, I have. Sorry, can I get a bison burger?
Have you in the coffee?
Well done.
French fries?
No thanks, but could I get it with cheese and mushrooms?
Sure. For you?
I'll have your popcorn shrimp with the marinara.
course. And can I get the disco fries, please? The fries with gravy and cheese.
Yes.
And I'll have the mozzarella cheese.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So, yeah, we would have eaten at Junior's, and then we got on the train and we were mucking with the G, pal. So it was a Sean Connery coitus
yeah, so
the
just,
whole time.
Just relax. You've only got 2 minutes of the terrible Sean Connery impression.
Yeah, so anyway, the G, I completely missed our stop on the G. We had to run around, get the train back. We're like, we're never going to make it. Then we got off at Lorimer Metropolitan
Avenue.
No, we
didn't. You thought we were going to go off at
Lorimer. No, that's where we ended up getting off.
No, we got off at Metropolitan.
Which the is the same, dude.
I know, but the reason we missed a stop is you were
I
waiting for Lorimer.
I would explain that bit.
You did? Okay. I wasn't listening. I was making
my
tea.
No, I know you were making your tea. You haven't listened to
me
the
doing,
whole time.
You were doing, no, I only did your Sean Connery impressions, do I not listen? Okay. Then I don't listen.
Yeah, well, anyway. So we got off at Lorimer / Metropolitan and walked around an entire block by mistake. So anyway,
yes,
we get to the cinema.
Did we just leave this avenue and then walk in a big circle?
We finally get to the cinema, right? And
this is my fault.
It's already
this bit is my fault.
It's already 6 minutes late. We asked the guy behind the counter,
which you weren't going to do. That was my idea, though. I said we should ask because you just wanted to go straight ahead and do Skyscraper. You were very pessimistic about the possibility of there being trailers before Yellow Submarine.
Well, only because it's a 50th anniversary.
I know. I'm with you. I just thought it was worth asking.
So we asked. Also, by the way, the other reason why I was pessimistic about asking was like he could say something, but honestly those guys really don't know.
They don't,
like,
he was
really
very specific about it starts in 6 minutes.
Basically the Williamsburg said. Cinema is a cinema run by 19-year-olds who really couldn't give a shash about anybody. They really are just like hanging out and whatever. Like there's really no manager there, there's no organization, there's no seniority.
No.
Just a bunch
people
of people
turn the lights on halfway through the movie.
Lights
sometimes.
On halfway through the movie, the movie's all quiet for a lot of it. So anyway, I run up to the counter. We're like, how many? He goes, the movie starts in about 6 minutes. You're all right. And I was like, how many tickets have sold? He's like, we've only sold about six, so the place will be fairly empty. We're like, excellent. So I buy a ticket on my movie pass and do the whole thing and get all excited, buy popcorn, buy water, and buy Crunchy Crunch.
Meanwhile,
cannot get signal on his piece of shit phone, which is derailed us I don't know how many times. MoviePass never works on your phone.
It doesn't.
Like my phone, it works first time. Your phone, you're there trying
in
to.
Order to see the movie,
eye.
In order to see the movie, I need signal. I need internet connection.
It's not just signal you need. The whole thing, even when you have signal, your phone is like, what am I doing now? You want me to open MoviePass?
It is. It's like, you know, like pets start to look like their owners, or owners start to look like their pets. My phone has started to look like me.
Your phone is you
it's
on a Sunday
like,
morning.
Yeah. What's that?
What's that for?
I don't know. It looks, I mean, it's.
Sorry, what was this for?
That's starting to break for the table.
Just for the general?
Yeah, for the table.
Okay, thank you. Cool.
I didn't order anything with garlic bread.
No, but maybe they're just giving us more. It's just garlic bread, I think.
It's a diner. Why am I getting garlic?
Hold on, I can't eat it. I can't get it.
All right, that's super gross.
Well, I'm good. I'm fine now.
Yeah. Wow, I can't believe you actually just did that. You just take it out of your mouth and put it back on the plate. You literally just bit through moon rock or something. You bit through a slightly glazed garlic moon rock. Also, there's a bit of red on there, and I'm like, why is there red on there? Where has this even come from?
Don't tell me there's red on the garlic bread. It could be blood from my mouth.
No, it wasn't. It's on, like, it's, I don't know. Put it down. I don't even know why we have it.
I can't turn down free food. Some of it's on a free plate of garlic rock.
This is...
Would you like some garlic buttered rock?
It might. They literally might as well have gone down to Brighton Beach, got a pebble and glazed it with a little bit of...
Hey, maybe that's the new speciality of the diner.
Butter. I don't know. Lick your lips. You got a little
sure
green...
It's not blood?
No, it's green.
Sure it's not bits of my teeth hanging
it's
out.
Whatever they've decided this is.
Garlic pebbles.
Chives or whatever.
So it's a new thing?
It's a new thing, apparently. Apparently diners now do garlic bread in the evenings, which makes absolutely...
Well...
Whatever.
It's very nice. I mean, the idea is very nice. The garlic
lovely.
Bread is terrible.
Well, but it doesn't make any sense. I'm confused by it. It's confused me. It's freaked me out. I'm worried. It is what it is. So...
Yeah, so we're there. Time ticking down. We've got to get the urgency back. We've got to get the audience in the moment.
Right.
I'm standing there holding a ridiculous... You're really going for a second bite of this thing?
Oh, we'll see if this one's
softer. The first one almost completely removed the front of your... Come on, don't even attempt it.
No, you're right.
Don't even attempt... Seriously, I can't even believe you're doing this. Seriously, are you that hungry that you're going to suck on
No, I'm not. I'm not even that hungry. I ate most of your popcorn, which I've started to do every week.
Yeah.
You very generously pass me the bag.
Yeah.
And every week you're passing me the bag with the thought of, Jim can have a little bit. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? I'm just being nice, let you have a little bit.
Yeah.
And then you have to grab it back off me before I eat the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's basically me and John are the same. I've spent my life trying to pretend that me and John are different, but we're not.
No.
If you give us snacks, we'll just keep eating
until
you literally take them away from us.
Yeah.
We've got no sense of decorum.
When I lived with John, there was almost every night. I would say there wasn't a night that went past where he would be like, did I see Kit Kats in the cupboard?
He's a very old school socialist, isn't he? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's like... It belongs to all of us now.
It does.
When you think about it.
It does. No, living with John was fascinating because it was one of those things where, like, you could never begrudge it, right? Because you're like, well, it's a slice of bread or it's a can of tuna or it's a Kit Kat or whatever. Like, you would just be like,
am I
really going to be the person that gets all bent out of shape over a third Kit Kat, let's say, or whatever? But then when you come home and go to the cupboard going, oh, I know I can make myself a sandwich, and after my sandwich I can have a Kit Kat, and you can't do it
because it's been eaten by John.
That's when you kind of go, I don't want to be the guy who gets mad
but I wish
about
I was.
Bread and the Kit Kats, but there it is.
But there it is. How many times do you think you, me and John, but how many times do you think you, me and John watch Yellow Submarine in Westcombe?
Oh, probably a whole bunch. And I watched it by myself a whole bunch as well.
Because I went through a stage where there was like I remember getting...
Should we say a conservative estimate is probably 8?
Well, I know we watched it along with the kids.
Yeah.
But then they brought out like an anniversary VHS, which must have been around 98. So I guess that's the 30th anniversary.
No, it also came out on DVD and it also came out... They released... So yeah, possibly 98...
It must have been 98.
It wasn't as late as 2008.
No, it must have been an anniversary because it's 68, right?
So it came out on VHS, later on DVD with the same cover, but for the first time ever, they released the soundtrack, including all the movie songs that are actually in the movie.
Right.
The original Yellow Submarine album is the 4 songs that are unique to the movie.
And then all George Martin stuff on the B-side, right?
No, plus the single All You Need Is Love and It's All Too Much, I think. And then...
Well, It's All Too Much is just for the movie.
Oh, yeah, okay. So, but It's All You Need Is Love and one other one is on the first half.
Right.
It's only like 5 or 6 tracks. And then the second half is all the George Martin orchestral stuff. And then they released, about 20 years ago, they released the CD, which was all the songs. I don't think there's any... orchestral on it. It's just the songs. So it includes, you know, Nowhere Man and all those other songs.
But we watched a whole bunch. When it was like...
And we watched it a whole bunch.
Yeah, like late teenagers and we watched it a lot. And especially when I was discovering certain substances at the time. And these certain substances left me in a state of mind that was very much stimulated by the idea of eating Kit Kats, usually yours, and watching
Yellow Submarine. Well, no, because when we were at yours, when we were in Westcombe...
Oh, that's when Mum had, like,
I didn't have
chocolate
them,
chip
no,
muffins.
I didn't have the money, but you guys would always send me down to get snacks. And so the joke always became that it would always be like Bobby's apple pie.
That's right, you'd come back with the world's most terrible snacks.
Well, because it was all I could afford.
Did we make you pay for the snacks?
Yeah.
Did we really do that?
Well, because John always used to make, like, why are we looking at, like, what was it, Abbott's Kitchen, like, jam roller or something? It was always, like, something disgusting. And John was always
I think we all chipped in with, like, different stuff.
Why did you get this? No, if we all went down together, we all chipped in. But there were occasions where you two would be sat on the couch being like, oh, enough of this, send Crossy down to One Stop. And I was always just happy to be involved.
Well, feel really terrible.
That's where the joke comes.
I'm feeling like a stabbing pang of guilt.
That's where the joke comes from.
I know the Bobby's apple pies.
But what was the other thing?
I've joined in on the joke.
What was the lemon slice that I got? Like, it was like ridiculous. But it was always like Abbott's Kitchen or Bobby's slice or whatever.
No, actually, you know what? Can I just... Because I'd like to...
Make yourself sound less awful.
We would tell you we would want. We would never make you. We never sent you down. What happened was you would come.
There were at least three occasions where I was sent down.
Okay, well, I just feel terrible.
That's right.
I do. I feel bad.
It's fine. But the Westcombe thing was always 2 litre bottles of Coke. We consumed a lot of 2 litre bottles of
Cherry Bakewells.
Cherry Bakewells. Your mum always, like, your mum bought, like, small batches of groceries, but they were always, like, the really tasty things. Like, she always had, like, the really tasty bacon, but there was only ever, like, 6 slices in a packet. And she always had, like, the really tasty cookies, but there was only, like, 3 of them.
Yeah.
But she would buy, like, weird small batch stuff.
But it was a thing where, for a little while, anyway.
Oh, perfect. Thank you. That's the ticket.
Thank you so much, lovely. Thank you very much.
I realise half the stuff I say these days, people are like, we don't have that expression here, mate. What are you talking about?
Yeah, that's I get a lot of that.
What does that mean? That's the ticket. I'm just saying, well, it's really good. Oh, that's all right then.
What worries me about that is it happens at work usually. And when I say it, and they don't know what I'm talking about.
Right.
It means I haven't said that phrase.
Right.
In whatever, you know, however long I've been in America, basically.
Right.
Which is a really weird thing to realise.
Well, also, I always get the thing where people are like, be more English. Then I am more English. And then they go, ha ha, what does that mean? You sound like an idiot. And I'm like, well, then I can't win. Because on one hand, you're saying be more English. And on the other hand, you're laughing openly at me when I say that's the ticket. Or
they don't want you to win, mate. They want to relive the humiliation of the War of Independence. That's what we're here for. Anyway, the connection story is that there was a period where we all loved the Beatles when we were teenagers. And we were shown, certainly when I was a kid, like I remember watching it around at Amos' house. Whenever we were all, me and John were sent round to my mum's best friend's house, and they had kids too, to shut us up, to stick us down in front of the telly and put on Yellow Submarine.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
And then that thing happened, same thing happened with Jungle Book, where then 10 years go by.
Yeah.
And you don't even think about that movie. Even though I got mad keen on the Beatles when I was about 13, 14.
Yeah.
Mad on the Beatles again. We all kind of fell in love with the Beatles at the same time. The band. Well, right?
I was a big fan because Mum was a big fan.
Why?
I think that unlike something like The Kinks or The Small Faces or whatever, which we kind of discovered together, or you got from your dad, but I didn't know as much until I knew you guys, the Beatles was something that I think I definitely knew from, like, birth. It was, like, one of Mum's favourite things. And we had, because our cousin had worked in Apple, we had the Yellow Submarine soundtrack, the original, on vinyl. In an unnumbered edition, so it didn't have the barcode, it didn't have the number, it didn't have anything on it. It's still in my collection, back in my dad's garage at home somewhere. But yeah, so we had a couple of those like late Apple pressings. Because this came out when? 68?
68.
It's not the next thing they do after Sgt. Pepper, is it? Or it's
no, it's after Magical Mystery Tour. I think it might even be after the White Album in terms of release.
Really?
It feels more the music feels more Magical Mystery Tour than White Album.
Yeah.
So it's got to be pre-White Album.
I think it's pre-White Album.
Yeah. But either way, anyway.
In
so
the video at the end, Lennon looks like he's just growing his mutton chops that he would have
true.
For
yeah,
the
yeah,
White
yeah.
Album.
Good point, good point. So,
although I have to say something.
Go on.
The video at the end, you always think of like Yellow Submarine, or certainly the music for it, as being like a late era Beatles sound. Mm. When you see them in that video at the end, you're like, they're all so fucking young. Now I know they started young, but you don't.
Yeah.
Their music is like so accomplished.
Mm.
And I know they had George Martin, and I know they had a bunch of help, and I know it's not just them and da 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 da. But like, they're like younger than we are right now in that video at the end, by the long way. Yeah, yeah, by like 12 years or something.
Yeah, they were.
They're in their late 20s, right? They're like 27,
yeah, they're in their late
20s. Yeah,
and they're basically the end of their careers. It was all downhill after this.
Well, I don't know. The White Album's bloody amazing.
The White Album's good, but it's like, you know, it's solo stuff with occasional help from other band members.
Maybe.
It's not really a Beatles album. Even like, even Abbey Road is like Paul twisting everybody's arm behind their backs to make an album.
Yeah, I guess so.
But anyway, I guess my point was that we loved it when we were kids, and then nothing happened for years, but we did become huge Beatles fans. And then roughly around the time, because of the big, you know, 30th anniversary re-release, it was a wrap. Because the other thing was, if you didn't have it on tape,
right,
and it wasn't on TV back in the day,
like, well, I had it. Well, this was the funny thing. I had it recorded. Now, this again was my experience, not with Westcombe, I don't think. But my experience at my house was that I had it recorded on VHS from Channel 4, possibly even from like the 80s, from like the 20th anniversary or something. And so I had it without the Hey Bulldog and without that whole ending bit and all the rest of it. That's like,
no, it's only a northern song,
right?
Which, watching it again today,
yeah, I'd completely forgotten that whole last bit. I'm like, I think I've only seen it like once or twice then.
I understand. If I could make, even though it's a, listen, it's a beautiful film, but you could definitely just lose It's an Only Northern Song. It could just go.
Right.
It does. It spoils the momentum of the movie a bit. It's like the third song very quickly in a row.
Yeah.
And it's like, we're just on the adventure. They just got this submarine. You know, that's, I mean, like, I was to see, and you could tell they were like, what are we supposed to do with this, George? What are we going to do with it? Sea of Science? I mean, it's like, he's taking the piss out of the Beatles.
Right.
Here you go. Here's a song taking the piss out. Here's a song with me being really bitter and not trying. You know, even though I like it, so, I mean, I like that song, but.
But, so what I was thinking while I was. No, 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 don't apologize. What I was thinking while I watched this was that as I was growing up, my animation touchstones, and this says a lot about my brain, was Terry Gilliam's animation in Monty Python.
Yeah.
The Beatles' Yellow Submarine.
Yeah.
Probably like Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
And then the one thing I also watched at your house over and over and over again, because you had it on VHS.
Fanducula?
No, was that Daffy Duck cartoon.
Oh, yeah. Duck Amuck.
The episode is called Duck Amuck. It was my favorite episode because it's like the meta episode, but also like this highly surreal, mad episode. It's the episode where they were like, well, we don't know what to do with Daffy this time around, so let's just have him like being tormented by the animator. So when I think about
too much to ask.
When I think about those being my touchstones, because I mean, yeah, sure, everything's great, thank you. You know, obviously I had seen The Jungle Book, Robin Hood, Basil the Great Mouse Detective. Like, I did, those were some Disney touchstones for me, and I did like them. But for me, it was, the thing I couldn't get enough of was Python animation and Yellow Submarine.
The weird thing about it is that even though the Beatles had like almost no involvement in it at all, except that bit at the end and throwing them some songs that didn't make it onto Sgt. Pepper,
right?
It's incredibly imaginative, but it's a lot. When I was watching, I was thinking this is a lot like that.
Right.
It's really imaginative, but it's also got a pleasing structure that's kind of quite like, well, let's just do this, which is like that. All their best music is like them. They didn't sit down and go, you know, John didn't sit down when he did like Strawberry Fields and, you know, go, oh, well, I'm gonna do this or whatever. It's just like they did what they fancied. They were just the first people to get there to this world of like recording music, and they just had loads of fun with it. And that's kind of what the media. Plus, it's like kind of silly, which like the Beatles are actually, like pre-White Album. Even like songs on the Wild, like quite silly. Like Rocky Raccoon's quite silly, and Continuing Story of what?
Which one's quite silly? That was Swallowed, isn't
it? Oh, Rocky Raccoon, Rocky Continuing Raccoon. Story of Bungalow Bill, Piggies. Like, these are quite silly songs.
Right.
You know, Savoy Truffle.
What was funny is, so the episode hasn't come out yet, but we were talking, you will hear it in Hammer Month, which will be August, where we will cover 4 Hammer horror films.
Yes, we will.
But I was telling you that recently I'd had a bit like of a dip back into... like the Bonzos.
Oh yeah.
And I've also been listening to like some other British Invasion stuff, like the Troggs and the Hollies and some other stuff, just because it's kind of come across my Spotify playlist. And also Kim is a big Hollies fan, and she bought an album where we were listening to it. There was just some stuff that I was listening to, and watching Yellow Submarine tonight, it really hit home. Like, the stuff on Yellow Submarine is probably closer to, and even stuff on Magical Mystery Tour and the White Album and some other stuff, is way closer to like the Bonzo Dogs than almost any other. I mean, maybe like Bits of Small Faces and stuff, but still, like the like cultural touchstones are not like, everyone always says, oh, you're a Rolling Stones fan or the Beatles fan. Well, like, there isn't really a comparison there. Like, you don't listen to any of it and go, well, this sounds like the Stones. Even the Stones at their most like weird and drugged out is not anything like this. Like, this is the music in this is so influenced by is as influenced by like old English folk songs, nursery rhymes, 1920s jazz, music hall, childhood, whatever, as it is by fucking rock and roll. There's barely a song on the soundtrack that could be rock and roll.
I mean,
Hey Bulldog has like that walking bass line piano, that dum 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 dum, which is like a, you know, that's like a driving,
quite silly, bluesy, quite a silly song.
Totally silly song.
But you're right. I suppose because the Stones, they had like one songwriting partnership, and there were 4 blokes in a band, and this was the kind of music that they all agreed they liked.
Right.
Whereas in the Beatles, when they're just recording stuff, if they don't have to play it live, if they know we never have to play this live, when Paul comes to you, you know, you're just kind of like working your way through your third chauffeur-driven limo that month or whatever, and Paul goes, hey, I've got this song, it sounds a bit like an old music hall tune about growing old. You're like, yeah, whatever, Paul. Do I have to play anything? No? Okay, fine, yeah, you crack on, mate. You know, it's like, not that they didn't care, but just had less to... They didn't have to think... I mean, I'm sure if Lennon was like, there's no way I'm playing when I'm 64, 75 times a year, you know.
Right.
Like, I'm not getting up on stage and playing this every fucking night. You can forget it.
Right.
Right? So you put like, yeah, okay, that's fun. That's kind of silly. So you're much less invested in it, I suppose.
Right.
It was a big deal that they made so much money. They were so free to do it. Well, of course, it drove them all mad, but... The film itself is just... The way it looks is so unique.
Well, it's unique.
And even now, like, you just there's like stuff, either pictures directly from the cartoon or things done in that style. There's just nothing else like it.
Right, because it's a mixture of so many different things. Like, no 2 scenes are really animated the same, except maybe like the 4 or 5 main characters are all sort of the similar animation. But like, sometimes it's, you know, cut out photographs in a kind of Gilliam style. Sometimes it's like actual drawn,
and they're all really effective
stuff
as well. None of it weird.
Sometimes it's film footage. Sometimes
even though it's quite flashy, like obviously it's like, wow, look at what we can do. Because it's this kind of, you know, literal trip where they're just moving through these magical lands, it makes total sense. And all that it's trying to do is convey some kind of emotion. And so the songs are much less intrusive. It's much less like, now you're going to sing a song about we are lost in the land of monsters or whatever.
Right, right, right.
It's like, we're going to use this song because it's like, we're just trying to convey this emotion of, I don't know, like with Nowhere Man. Like, Nowhere Man works really well. They meet a character who does like nothing for the story, fixes the submarine, and then climbs up a bit at the end. But it just, that moment, that song, perfectly fits. And like the emotions they get out of the song, like the sadness and like rescuing a guy, it's like it totally brings the song to life and then makes everything okay as well.
Right.
It's not just like in the album, oh, that's a nice catchy song by Lennon. He was probably feeling a bit down that day. That's right. It. But instead, it like brings the whole thing to life.
Well, when is that from? That's from like Rubber Soul. 65.
Yeah, that's Rubber Soul.
I agree with that. No, because I think it's more.
I'm sitting around going bomb.
Right. But that's what, yeah, so I mean, for people who don't know, and you should know it, but it's like, oh, that was the other touchstone, is Magic Roundabout. Yeah. The other animated touchstone. Like, it's funny. I never grew up to do drugs. I never did hallucinogens. I'm never, like, I'm not, wasn't a big pot smoker even when we were all smoking pot. But, like, those, like, that was what was firing my imagination. Mm. And it's still fire. I still find all those things more interesting. And you can throw in, like, Harryhausen and some other stuff. But, like, that stuff will always fuel my imagination way more than like fucking Mickey Mouse and, you know, whatever, like any of the Disney stuff. It just wasn't what I grew up on. Hence why I'm a deeply, deeply strange bloke. But no, what's great about it as well is that the characters, I guess because the Beatles had maybe at that point become somewhat sort of parodies of themselves. But like I think what is lost if all you know is the Beatles' music now, 50 years later, is their personalities. Now, I grew up being so much into the band that I've seen all their interviews. I've seen, you know, the anthology multiple times. I've seen the uncut anthology on DVD multiple times. I've seen clips of them on the Ed Sullivan Show and blah, 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 blah. They were, I think people forget, but they were like the Marx Brothers meets music. Like, they were so quick-witted and so, but also like delightfully British and sort of esoteric. And there's really no one compared to them. You can't, you know, so many people are like, well, they were just the boy band of their generation. Well, no, like there's no, like you can't, you know, if there was a boy band that even had some like witty quips or whatever, they would be written by a room or a team full of writers. This, now, even if they did have help, or even if they did crib some lines or whatever, this felt like it came right off their head all the time. And what's amazing, considering they're not anything to do with the film, is how they get that essence. They have George's essence, they have
what's
Paul's
funny,
essence.
Yeah, what's nice,
and
is,
you
they
wonder
sort of poke
if,
fun at them a little bit.
They do.
They poke fun at George a little bit.
Right, they poke fun at the fact that McCartney at the beginning is like conducting some like large orchestra and comes out and someone throws him flowers and he like adjusts his tie. He's like, yeah, I know I'm the best.
I wondered about the whole, and I don't know this for sure, but I'm wondering if they like went to John and were like, hey John, we're doing this movie, could you, you know, got anything you want to put in there, some funny lines? And then I don't know, John like tried to hit them with a hammer or, I mean, I said something so cutting that they just wanted to give up and go home. Whether they're like him being a monster and then drinking a little potion, actually he's an alright bloke, because I mean he was like a bully,
right,
and a swine. Like he was those things,
right,
particularly to strangers. But I wonder whether, because you're right, then, you know, George is sitting with like wind blowing in his hair, looking like a wee, like cool, but like a bit pompous. Do you know what I mean? On top of the thing with the sitar music, right? And like Ringo's kicking around, feeling sorry for himself. Like there's obviously there's attempt to draw it, but they're clearly.
And also, let's not
forget, clearly
you have
to
a hard, you have a Hard Day's Night and Help, which come before this, which kind of establish their characters.
But like they were definitely making fun of George a little bit.
Yeah.
But well, then he's one of the coolest characters, isn't it?
But there's also, yeah, because the joke is, it's like, what day is it? Oh, it's sitar day.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they open the door and he goes, oh, George must be in here then. And it goes up and like George is there and it's all like twang, nang, 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 nang. And there's like old yellowy pictures of like cattle moving through like dusty fields and stuff. And then he's suddenly driving around in the car.
In the car, it's great.
It's all in the mind.
It's all in the mind. But that's the thing, like you forget. And the thing, so, much like with anything that you rediscover when you're growing up, this was great because it was really fun, and the music's obviously great. But there's so many tiny little funny bits in it.
Oh yeah,
like the way George dances in When I'm 64, and the way waves, where the wave, the way they all wave out of the side of the submarine, and the, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, if anything,
they're just playing around. You
if
know,
if there's anything that hampers it, it's probably because of the slightly amateur nature of the, like, main character animation. Hampers it. No, the reason why...
Yeah, lovely. Great, thank you.
When I'm 64 starts off, there's this, like, really beautiful, like, funny, cute image of them all with enormous beards.
Oh, yeah.
All, like, moving to the sound of the music.
Yeah.
And then, like...
Old Fred comes over
in the front, right? But then after that, it doesn't. It goes off and just, like, well, we're going to do numbers and we're going to do whatever, right? They're kind of like, you kind of want there to be a whole music video of them all with beers.
I agree.
Like, and it's clear that they animated that bit when, oh, that's perfect, just like, let's not do any more of that, and just went off and did
I know what you mean, because I think obviously the you know, the
like
thing
Nowhere that, Man's the same. They just, the second half of the song is in the animation's in reverse to what it is in the first half.
Yeah, but I know what you mean. But on those two particular subjects, right? They're going to the thing where they go, a minute is a long time,
right?
Here, let us demonstrate, and then they count out the minutes of the animation. I know that is kind of, but equally, it reminded me that it's a kids' film. It is a kids' film, and that thing about a minute and the different numbers and stuff, it's very childlike. And I remember when I was, granted, a little bit baked, but I remember thinking, fucking hell, man, a minute is really long. Look at this. Look how long. And it's so genuinely.
No, I get all that.
No, I know what you mean, but I'm saying, and then even on the backwards animation bit, I remember finding that quite touching, because it was like, it wasn't just that cool, but that they really were like withdrawing from him and leaving him on his own.
Completely. I'm not knocking what exists. I love the film unabashedly. What I'm saying is, I would also love When I'm 64 with them all doing that dance.
I agree,
for like the whole thing.
But that's the point, isn't it? Because
we get the moment of it, and you're like gleeful.
No, I know what you mean. In other words, if you were to, you know, if you were to cut down the number of songs and beef up the amount of adventure with the four Beatles, it would be a better film. But the thing that I liked about it, even watching it this time, but especially when I rediscovered it, was that it was so... It didn't give a shit about anything. It was what it was. And if it wanted to do, like the bit where the sun rises over Liverpool, and then...
That is amazing. You know, it's one of my favourite shots in cinema.
Right. And it's just like... It's a totally different animation style. They never repeat that again in the movie.
The Eleanor Rigby sequence is genuine. It's pop art. Like, it's pop art. Like,
and it totally...
Art, and
when I was watching, I was like, this totally encapsulates what football is to cross it. Like the blue team doing that, and then the red team doing that, and the ball's going to move, and they're all like proper clever. You know, I mean, they clearly hired people in to make silly faces.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, that basically is football. I can't really argue with that.
Do you know what also I thought about was that, like, there's a couple of sequences in there where two women in the window eating the cakes, or the guy with the little dog that runs
up
really and then
touching.
Runs back.
That gets me in the feels.
It's all repetitive. It's all...
Yeah.
They've animated like five frames and they're but it's sort of what a meme is, like a GIF rather. And it's odd. Like, to me, I'm like, we see images like this all the time now.
Yeah.
Like, you can have GIFs that go forward and back and then forward and back, so they're kind of on a perpetual loop. And that's kind of become something that's just in the lexicon now. Like, everyone kind of is aware of repetitive imagery, moving imagery. But this was done like back in, you know, 1967, 1968.
And meant to convey something very particular.
And it's interesting that whatever that is, that motion, that emotion, that style, that whatever, you know, it's like that thing in Annie Hall where they're talking about photography and he's saying, like, you know, a set of criteria has not emerged yet as to what, like, photography should be, and like you see the subtitles underneath. It's odd that, and I'm trying to say something here, but like within human creativity, within human entertainment and creativity, and wherever that line is met, there's clearly criteria in there that you could analyze. Like you could draw lines and, you know, make charts and graphs and boil it down to like, well, this touches us because of this, or this amuses us because of this, or whatever it is. But like the fact that it's sort of eternal from the cave paintings to now, you know, and the fact that like that amazing documentary by Werner Herzog, The Cave of Forgotten Dreams, where you see early man painting on the walls, and they're not just drawing an animal, they're drawing like a herd of animals like running, so they've drawn like the lines on for movement and stuff. Like there's something in that that is inherently, yes, it's nature and it's life and it's life, but it's inherently human as well, in the way that we react to things and the way that we animate things and the way that we create things. And like that through line to me is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, and I think that if anything else, like that's, and like you know, you weren't even stoned when you watched it, but like that's what watching the movie does to you. It really makes you think about the Eleanor Rigby sequel, you know, segment made me think like, Christ, am I stuck in that life?
Right.
Like, is that where I found myself? You know? And then the like freeing people through music and. I don't know. It really makes you think about all of it, and it just how free they must have felt to like make this. And like hand this in. I don't know who the distributor or the producer was, but it must have gone.
I do the distributor. It was a.
By the way, my favorite bit.
It was a subsidiary of an American company, and I forget which one it was, but I saw it in the opening credits, and I was like, "Oh, that's fascinating. I must remember that." And then I've forgotten it. But
Hearst. It was Hearst. It was the Hearst Corporation.
Hearst.
Yeah, which is like really.
Yeah, like Randall.
Yeah. But the bit just. It gave me like some goosebumps because I'd forgotten it, but it's just one of those things when Apple Films Presents comes up, I don't know why, but like that gets me. I suppose it's like, hey, you're watching Yellow Submarine, you know,
right?
I could honestly watch that film over and over and over again. It's not really a story, but it's so beautiful to look at, and it's so peaceful and hopeful and full of joy and silliness, and it's what I would want life to be. And you know, the Eleanor Rigby sequence and the thing that they're rescuing Pepper Land from, which is this like grayness and fear and, you know, do what you're told and, you know, don't move and just fucking stay there, don't think, don't speak. And I, you know, we all want to be rescued from that.
And I
it's one of these things that you don't realise until you watch films, particularly English films from the 60s and 70s, was how fucking awful England was in the 60s and 70s. Like how grey and just desperate the fucking country was.
Right.
And so that, the notion of sitting in the theatre in some grey fucking place, like Solihull,
full of smoke.
You know, you spent your time.
Because it's all Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. It's all that.
And then this fucking hat. And it's not going to be like Stone Dusty. It's like for kids, and it would have been like the, you know, this is the Beatles movie. Because by then, nobody knew that they'd all gone fucking barking mad and they're about to try and kill each other. At that point, it was still like, oh, the fucking Beatles, the biggest band in the world. The only thing that England's done, you know, since losing a war, basically, that like anybody knows us for, particularly.
Losing a war?
Well, you know. We didn't really win World War II. Someone else did. We just didn't lose it. Oh, well, I guess we kind of did. It doesn't really matter. We don't want to get into a World War II discussion.
Okay.
We didn't win. We just didn't get invaded. And we just, like, hung on. Well, until someone more powerful came along and, like, helped. Anyway.
Don't give them all the credit.
We can give them most of it.
All right.
Anyway. But my point is, you're sitting there, this fucking thing comes on the screen. Yeah, you know, with all that matter. And it wouldn't have been, like... It wouldn't have been alienating, I don't think. It wouldn't have been like, oh, I didn't get all this psychedelic stuff. It would have been joyful and silly and
weird. It's not psychedelic in a way that's... It's not psychedelic in the way that the like...
The dance sequences.
Flower, like the flower power, you know, Jefferson Airplane... you know, dancing around. It's not psychedelic in the way that the San Francisco movement was psychedelic, no. Which was far more in a kind of alienating, well, those are those people. They go out to parklands, take their tops off, take acid and run around. Like, it's not, it's surreal, and it's surreal in a kind of, you know, there's nods to Escher in there, there's nods to Dali in there, there's nods to Magritte. And like, it's surreal with, like, a sense of artistic history and European vibes.
Yeah, it's proper surreal when it goes there.
And it's got that thing where, you know, it's got that wonderful Englishness. Like, Pepperland is this place that has, like, a bandstand. Like, it's not a rock band at the end. It's, guys with tubas and trumpets and stuff.
There's a little bandstand with, like, little garden chairs around it.
Yeah. It's, like, proper. Now, the Beatles never quite went the way of, like, the Kinks or the Small Faces with the, like, Village Green Preservation Society or Ogden's Not Gone Flake. But, like, that's woven in there. You know, they're a little bit too, like, London and Carnaby Street for that, a little bit. But, you know, you were saying earlier about, like, Britain being very grey and depressed. If you talk to my mum, who was 16 in 1969, saw the Beatles on Abbey Road rooftop, lived right in North London, was a hippie, you know, into the music of Clapton and Hendrix and the Stones and Beatles and Dylan and everything else, right? She had a totally different experience of the 60s than my dad did, working for Lloyd's Bank, driving around a little, like, you know, Morris or whatever, doing on the inspection staff of, like, Lloyd's Bank with, like, an old duffer called Teddy Hampton. That's absolutely true. Like, he went with Teddy Hampton, apparently he doesn't talk like that. Teddy Hampton. Dad's told me so many vivid stories about Teddy. And you could just see him in his little pork pie hat, his tweed jacket, like, driving around little Morris with my dad and some other guy in the back seat, because there was always three of them on a team. And, you know, with their packed lunches and their little brown raincoats. And, you know, that's his experience in the 60s, because you move anywhere outside of London and no one's having that experience. You know, yeah, all right, you have the Isle of Wight Festival, maybe, like, Brighton and the South Coast has a few little things, but, like, anywhere outside of there, nobody's given a toss, you know what I mean?
And so, you know, you sit there in the cinema and you come across this.
I think we're all done.
You know, and this is what you see. I think it would be hopeful and joyful and funny and silly and cool. And,
yeah.
You know, it would have been a hell of an experience. I mean, it's a hell of an experience for me. 30 years later, granted, quite stunning. It was 30 years later. That blew my mind as well.
Right.
And not in a blew my mind. Yeah. In a. Thank you very much. I felt a connection to being, like, a kid again.
Right.
But also knowledge that I was watching something that was going to shape. Like, right. how I felt about the world, but how you see things. Like, I see things now, and it reminds, you know, certain animations or certain parts of movies or even, like, things in the real world remind me of Yellow Submarine.
Right.
You know, like, specifically, not oh, that's a bit, you know, spy thrillery or whatever. Like, specifically, right, this thing. And when you're watching it for the first time, when you're, you know, grown up. Like, that's what I was aware of. I'm watching something that is gonna, like, be burned on my brain.
Right.
Like, that's gonna, like, you know, the first time I think now. Like, the first time I heard Muswell Hill, but it's like the Kinks album.
Right.
Like, the first time I heard that, while I was listening to it, I was thinking, this is going to be with me forever.
Right.
I'm never going to forget this album. Like, these songs are going to be,
yeah,
like, lines from them and, like, bits of music are just going to, like, replay throughout the rest of my life. And I felt that way about Yellow Submarine as well.
Yeah.
It's so unique and so, so powerfully evocative of, like, just a nonsense land and a nonsense world, but it was a it didn't need a plot or even, like, particularly obstacles to be. I mean, what do? They just turned up and they, like, sang songs, and that's all they did. There was no, like, great plan or anything.
No,
you know, they just snuck into the place, stole some instruments, played music, three songs, defeated the meanies, the end, right?
Right.
But it was, like, such a glorious thing to be a part of, you know. And I wanted weird to be on the submarine, like travelling through that land of the sea of monsters and the sea of hulls and the sea of green and all the rest of it, you know? Obviously not a sea of science, clearly I could have lived without that. But, yeah, it was, and it was no, I wasn't disappointed watching it now. Like, I didn't, even though nearly every time I watched it, when it came out and I had it on the VHS and everything, I was a bit, usually a bit stuck. But this time, I was still just sitting there being, thinking, this is amazing. This is utterly beautiful and brilliant and funny and cool. And,
well, the song, especially now, the songs don't... So first of all, let me finish that up. Especially now, the songs don't sound like anything that's around anymore. Like, when we were probably at our height of watching this in the 90s, there was the whole Britpop scene, which everyone said, oh, this sounds just like Small Faces, the Kings of the Stones, and the Beatles, which it didn't. I mean, Oasis never really sounded like the Beatles. I mean, okay, they put a couple of trumpets on a song. Doesn't mean that sound like the Beatles.
They were the Stones.
Well, they weren't talented enough to be the Beatles or the Stones, really. But anyway, and Blur never really... I mean, yeah, all right, Blur sounds a bit like Small Faces in certain things, especially like... Park Life sounds incredibly like Ogden's Not Gone Flake, but yeah. Like beyond that, and I think admittedly so, I think they're doing that as a thing. Yeah. But beyond that, that whole like Britpop scene being another 60s never really plays out. Like you can't really make sorry. But there were bands at the time, whether it's Blur, Pulp, Oasis, whatever, that are influenced by that period, right? So it's 30 years later and, you know, England's having its musical moment in the map again, right? And the thing with it is that now, another, whatever it's been, 20 years since then, or 25 years since then, that we're even more detached from it. The music doesn't, and certainly living in the States, the music I listen to on a daily basis doesn't sound like this. I don't, you know, outside of like the Bonzos or the Beatles themselves. And we're far enough detached from the period of time where I was listening to the Beatles like every day and watching their movies every week, which I did. Like I watched Hard Day's Night and Help probably 15, 20 times each, like just week after week, like all the time. I loved it. It was like watching, I would go around yours and watch like your mum's Marx Brothers VHS, and then I would like watch Help or whatever, and it was like a British Marx Brothers. Like I could just enjoy the knockabout silliness of it with the quips and whatever. And the thing is that the songs sound so much, and it's not just because they've been remastered, but they sound so new and fresh.
And of a kind, too.
And of a kind.
Even they're going from Rubber Soul all the way through to, 68. That's... I know it's only 3 years, but like now 3 years is like, you know, 2 albums maybe. But for them, that was, I don't know, what, Rubber
now,
Soul,
3 years, you'd be lucky to get one album.
Yeah, it's like 5 albums, right?
5 albums. And they're 5 of probably the best albums ever made by anyone ever.
But yeah, it's weird because when I love them, Rubber Soul sounded like totally different to me than Peppers or the White Album. Like, just like, and if, in my head, I guess because I was so young. Like, those 4 years seemed like... Because that was the difference between being 14 and 18.
Right.
And back then, between 14 and 18 is massive. It's enormous. I'll never be that old. I'll never be 18. Right. What would that even be like? Right. You know, that'd break my brain.
Right.
And yet, now, it's like, fucking 4 years zip by while you have tiny shoes. You know what I mean?
Right.
But then, it's like, that sense of, like, how much people change...
Right.
...seemed natural when you, like... discover it.
Right. And also, the other thing is that we were all at that period of time discovering our own creativity. You know what I mean?
Like they were. Like every album is like, hey, fucking hell, we can do this.
Now, you know, it was before I had necessarily played any of my stuff to you guys, but like, because that was a bit later when you heard some of my more quote unquote serious songs, whatever that means.
Not ones about Chicken Tikka Masala.
Right. But I had a 4-track, audio cassette 4-track since I was probably about 15, 16. And I have about probably 10 tape cassettes no one's ever heard of me doing those kind of songs where you experiment, you know? Like, on one hand, you're doing the very angsty teenage, you know, writing about, like, you know, love and loss and all this stuff. And on the other hand, I'm doing songs where I'm like, oh, wow, there's an echo effect. Great, I'm going to do that. Wait, I can play this backwards. I'm going to try that. I can plug the mic through my guitar pedal so that I can have it be all, like, distorted and weird. But there's tracks where I'm just like, you know, like, I'm saying whatever. I don't know, like, I'm the Elephant Man or whatever it is. And it's like, and I'm, like, doing weird, like, echoes and loops and stuff. Like, all that stuff is not only inspirational when you hear the Beatles do it, but, you know, it's like having a canvas with a paintbrush and not worrying about, like, keeping within the lines or keeping within any form or keeping within whatever. And just kind of doing whatever you want to do. It doesn't have to be a 3-minute song that's about holding someone's hand. It can be whatever the fuck you want it to be. No, not yet. No, sorry. Thank you.
Do they want to take off?
I think the last point, and this was something that you said earlier that sort of touched me and inspired me as well, is this. I don't know about you, but like, and I don't know whether it was a result of having to be or whether it was just the things I watched or the things I listened to. But I was extraordinarily, as a lot of people are, idealistic when I was a teenager in terms of love and in terms of... how people should be with each other and the future of the world and my philosophy and whatever. It was all like that idealistic stuff. And I don't know about you, but I was told time and time and time again from about the age of 14, 15, whenever I was brave enough to like speak up and be like, I'm having these feelings, by the way. I was told routinely between about the age of 14 and probably well into my 20s, well, that's ridiculous. You can't think that. You're only 16. You don't know what you're talking about. This is what we tell people all the time. And thankfully, I get to 38. And that flame was never extinguished. I still watch... whether it's Yellow Submarine, whether it's The Last Waltz by the band, whether it's the Tragedy Hip concerts or whatever, I watch that and believe in the power of music and believe in the power of love and believe in a hopefulness and a positivity in a deep down guttural you'll never rip this from me human way. And you go through, you know, you go through so many ups and downs in your life in terms of, you know, one minute you're like, yeah, fucking, you know, all you need is love and da 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 da, and that speaks to me and da da da. And the next minute you're like listening to Bell Hicks and you're like, yeah, you're right, we're just a virus with shoes and fuck everybody and blah blah blah. Right. And all of it informs you, all of it does. You know, and then you have the Monty Python thing and Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry thing of like laughing at hierarchy and your elders and, you know, so you start stripping away, well, church doesn't mean anything, the school doesn't mean anything, and politicians don't mean anything, da 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 da. You know, but then the fact that there'll always be that moment, and it's more often than not with music, but it happens with film as well, especially film that has that like musical understanding. So like a director like Wes Anderson, I feel like as much as people can criticize him, I think he has a real understanding of imagery and music like put together and how that can manipulate an audience or how that can make an audience feel. And the fact that I've come, you know, 25 years now, 23 years now, and can watch something like It's All Too Much at the end of Yellow Submarine and All You Need Is Love and still have those feelings and still be like, as dark as the days feel and as difficult as everything feels right now, there's something inside me that goes, I wish everyone could like see this right now. I wish everyone could understand this right now. Not in a hold hands, stick flowers and guns, everyone hugging. Not in that way. In a way where really all you need to do is just nudge people occasionally and go, it'll be all right. Or nudge people occasionally and just say, you know what, if you took a deep breath and you looked at the things you do have in your life and just tried to love those things a little more than you hate all the other things, it'll be all right.
Yeah.
We'll get past this.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to, all you need is love doesn't have to be, you know, this wishy-washy, idealistic, you know, get rid of the grit, get rid of the grime, get rid of complaining. It doesn't have to be this, we all have to walk around like, you know, Hindu cows. It can be all the things that humanity is, but just occasionally when shit is just too much, we go, remember, we could always try this other thing where we're just a little nicer to each other and maybe we listen to some music that makes us feel good.
Maybe it's that message, you know, that the all you need is love is not saying necessarily all there is love or all there should be.
Right.
But, like, all you need.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, because, as you rightly point out, we find ourselves living in a world right now where we need fucking something, you know,
right?
We need something, and when you see something like that movie, and when what they're doing is they're saying, all you need is love, all you need is love and music and joy, and you know,
right. And it's different for everybody, right? So for us, our, you know, poking our faces into the light for the week is doing this.
Yeah.
Someone else, it's hiking up a mountain. Someone else, it's, you know, going to a concert or whatever. Right. Other people, whatever it is, painting, classes, yoga, whatever. You know, people go do those things. And I think what gets me down more than almost anything in the news is when people go, well, we can't do that, it's ridiculous. Because that way you've cut the potential off before you've even started.
Yeah, and after all, like, the world is the history of the world. Like, that's the thing. Like, with a lot of the Beatles' music, they're all reaching for something.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And it's, and usually what they end up with is, like, they compromise with something. And it's not like that they start off with some grand vision, but when they're doing it and thinking, we should try this, and then even though they can't reach it because they haven't got the equipment or whatever, then they could go about it a different way, or they try and get something that'll be kind of like that, or echo it, or be inspired by it, or whatever. But the reaching is everything. It's when people go in there and, like, let's just do what we do,
right?
You know, that you end up, like, not really doing anything, like, unless you're really reaching for something that you maybe never going to achieve,
right?
And that's what you're... And that's
but it's also when people assume the conclusion before they've even walked through the door.
Right. But that's what... That's why,
which is fear. Everyone has it. I'm not saying it's a bad thing.
But that's why it's a beautiful movie, because it doesn't even evoke... It doesn't even have things in it that are... All the evil and the cruelty and whatever are all, like, other creatures, like the blue meanies. You know, right. They're, like... I don't know whether they're metaphors or just, like, silly cartoon characters. But they're not real. All the people in Pepperland are recognized as a human, and the Beatles are obviously human, and old Fred, and they're all human beings, but the only people who are bad, as it were, evil, are these, like, creatures who could be anything, whatever. But it doesn't even have, like, or like a, you know, a villain who's a bit likable or whatever. Because
sorry, I'm going home, but you can
can we give you our card?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So we're just
half and half.
Half
no
and half. Thank you very much. You know, the beauty of the film is it's all, like, everybody's just trying to find the joy
right
in life.
Yeah, and it's the fact that if you are, if you're like the lead blue meanie, you know, at a certain point, it's a lot harder and a lot more difficult to continue the pretense of being evil than it is to relax and let some of that light and love into your heart. Because as cynical and as miserable and as greedy and as negative as any human can be, the worst of all people can be, there is a vast section of human nature has to do with, whether we deny it or not, love, togetherness, family, unity, call it whatever you will. Like, you know, my family isn't necessarily made up of people in my family, but, you know, some of it is. And so the more you deny that, the more you fight that, and the more you kind of slip into, you know, the other way, something's got to give.
Well, that's why it works so well, having that Eleanor Rigby sequence at the beginning, where it totally encapsulates that mood of hopelessness and loneliness and despair, frankly, a little 5-minute piece. And then everything after that is aspirational and hopeful. And like, even the people who are like drawing the pictures and creating the world don't have a definite idea of what it is. Like, they don't know where the seas are or how this fucking works, or the submarine, like, is this the real sea, or are they in another dimension? Like, it doesn't even matter.
No.
Because they're just, they're
reaching. Well, Pepperland is apparently thousands of leagues under the ocean, and yet everyone's breathing and walking around.
So the point is, everything is, thank you. The point is, everything's, you know, everything is aspirational, and everything is, thank you. It's just trying to find, joy, I guess. Everybody involved in it is just trying to create something amazing and wonderful and that looks great and is fun and silly and cool that they can be proud of. So they're not trying to tell a story even particularly. You know, no more than the Beatles are necessarily trying to hit anything particular. They're just trying to create something that they think is cool.
Well, you know? Yeah, I mean, the hardest.
And it's quite rare to have a film, like a whole film from start to finish, where clearly all anybody cares about is, this is cool, right? We're going to make something that's, you know, that's cool, looks good, and it's kind of fun. And like, when people go, well, wait, how do they get to the sea? Like, you know, you have whole writers' rooms puzzling over, how do they get through the sea of green? How do they get to the sun? What's the, you know, where's the hero's journey? And, you know, how are we going to flip the, where are the jokes for the grown-ups? You know, stuff like it would be, they tried to make this now. It would be fucking.
Well, they did. They tried to do a remake with
fucking Zemeckis, right?
And Peter Serafinowicz was going to be one of the voices. Right now we got, because he, you know, he does like McCartney well. And,
oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I'm glad that never came.
I tell you what it would be. It would have been really good, you know, and it would have had this great story, and it would have been like you know, Pixar movies and Marvel movies. It would have been like micro-tuned to like absolute peak entertainment. But there's just a little bit of a feeling of, you know, like, oh sorry, like with the Marvel movies, there's a bit of like, really, if we're honest with ourselves, this is too slick to have any soul. There's no soul here, really.
No.
You know, it's just everybody doing what they do well, finding the best people to create a fun blockbuster.
The thing I miss from movies are the mistakes.
Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah, and the whole.
I do. Like I miss the guy in the rubber suit. I miss the wonky camera. I miss the animation. I miss the missing frame. I miss the mistakes. I miss people trying to do something. Nowadays, people don't have to try. If you're already in the industry, obviously people have to try to get into the industry. Once you're in the industry, there's no trying to make a professional product. There, you know, spit and hit someone who knows how to use a camera and put it on a tripod and film it, and it'll be in 1080p, and you can project it anywhere in any cinema in the land, and you know, you can get a local band to score it, and away you go. Like, there's no mistakes anymore. But no one's like on the forefront of anything. But it's all been done.
But that's the thing. All my favorite bits in the cinema. All my favorite bits are all. It's all throwaway stuff.
Right.
All the throwaway gags. Or like, yeah, that's funny. Leave that in. Or stick that in. Or whoever was doing the voices were like, you know.
And the fact that twice like they have that. Well, they do though, don't they? Well, they do though, don't they? Well, they do though, don't they?
You know. Or what should we do now? Serve tea. Lovely. Like that's, you know.
Yeah.
Jonathan even gave me a Zippo lighter with that quote. We loved that so much. It's a throwaway line they thought was quite funny when they were like doing the voices, but they just left in. But nobody sat down and went, at this moment in the script, it's vital that they serve tea, and it's lovely, you know, like,
but little things like where should we go, Max? Argentina. Like, why?
But MC Korsakov. Well, I'm assuming that might have been a Nazi joke, but I don't know for sure.
It's so good though,
you know. And
this reminds me of Pompeii.
Yeah. It's all throwaway stuff that just made it in because they thought it was cool and fun. The whole movie is like this. Someone went, well, listen, we're thinking of, like, you know, putting this monster in. Yeah, fine, fuck it. It's cool, it's fun, leave it in.
Yeah.
The whole movie's like that.
Yeah.
It's so difficult not to fall in love with something that only wants to share, like, fun and joy and silliness with you.
Right.
That has no other... agenda than that.
Yeah, and it just feels like
we're going to use these great songs to take you somewhere that's just silly and fun and joyful. You know, I'm going to make you actually
think
you feel a lot in that movie, like you're saying about It's All Too Much or Nowhere Man or whatever. Like, you feel stuff when you're watching it,
and it's almost why, like, and it's weird to connect this to, like, something like Rampage or Geostorm.
You go for it,
or whatever. But it's no, but it's something like, and I get it, Rampage was based on a computer game, but it was based on a bloody weird computer game.
Right.
And someone sat around and was like, well, we've got this rock guy, and, like, he's enormous and ridiculous, and, you know, what should we have him do? Well, we've had him fight a natural disaster, and we're going to have him fight up a skyscraper with one leg, and in between those things, how about we have him fight, like, a giant flying wolf with a huge silver gorilla? And someone went, yeah, that sounds great. Like,
you're right, the reason that works is precisely because of that theme.
It works because... I mean, yes, it's slick. It's slickly CGI'd, and, you know, he has a journey and a beat.
But what makes it fun is what you're talking about.
But what makes it an entertaining movie for the 90 minutes or the 2 hours that it's on is that it doesn't have any pretensions about being anything other than what it is. And when they go, like, well, we can create three monsters, what monsters should we create? One of them was like, well, let's make a flying wolf or whatever. Like, they just put shit together and just, like, did it. And it was kind of fun and different and interesting. Maybe I'm stretching a bit, but I just mean...
No, I know what you mean, but I think that the people... I think you're right. And the feeling that we're talking about, I think people got brought onto the project and went... This is a project where the rock teams up with giant animals and cities get destroyed. So there's no point in taking this seriously, so we may as well have fun. And that attitude, I think, is what rescues it.
Right.
But what I like about Yellow Submarine is clearly from the beginning,
nobody had anybody say,
I'm just saying, but that's what happens. If you take that feeling you're talking about, which is like, fuck it, we have nothing to lose. Like, this movie is going to get released, and the rock is going to be in it, and it's going to be a thing. So we've got literally nothing to lose here. So we may as well just, like, go to fucking town with the scene, and that's why it works. But if they'd started with that frame of mind, it would have been a much better movie.
Like, right.
It was a good, fun movie, don't get me wrong. But if the same people who, like, polished it up had started the whole thing, but with that same fuck it, who gives a shit.
Do we know that didn't happen?
Well, no, because remember we kind of speculated that there were, like, three different plot lines, and clearly it developed, you know.
Yeah, no, but I'm just... what I'm trying to say, what I was trying to look for... is that in this world of slickness and in this world of 90% of what we're going to watch is polished and
focus group,
is there room for those kind of things? And I don't mean the... You know, the problem is with, like, the B-movies, right? Because someone would say to me, well, yeah, sure, there's plenty of independent people out there making monster movies in their backyard. And I'm like, yeah, but the trouble is every time I see them, they suffer from the same problem that the blockbusters do, which is they're doing it so knowingly. There's no sense of fun in doing, you know, Beach Babe Bimbos from the Moon fight Godzilla, whatever your thing is. Because you're like, well, all right, I get it. You're referencing this, 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 and this. And you're doing it because you're like, well, we've got TNA and some gore in it and a monster. But there's no sense of, like...
There's not a lot of joy. It's quite empty.
There's no joy or creativity.
It's like cynical.
There. Just
cynical.
Right. Or... And that's not the case for maybe every single one of them, but it's the case for, like, the majority of the B-movies I see.
Mm.
Do you know the last one? I tell you what. John dies at the end. Had that
sense. I didn't
like that. You didn't like it, but it had that sense of weird, funny...
Yeah.
Silliness about it.
Yeah. I still think that's...
I think maybe you'd be like, yeah, but it was written for crack, so therefore it's, like, knowing and pretentious. But I think the way Coscarelli made it, it shaved some of the hipsterness off of it.
I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that. I don't think that spirit is gone. I think that's still knocking around.
I'm just trying to find it.
But anyway.
Baba Hotep was another great. I'm listing Coscarelli movies, but like, that's another great example of like. And I think somewhat like a writer, like I've watched the two series of Hat and Leonard, and especially the second season. But like, I think Joel Lansdale has that, like those weird and wonderful ideas. Sure, within a genre, but like those weird and wonderful ideas, and it's still kind of out there writing them.
I mean, I don't know. I think that my.
I'm trying to look for hope.
No, and I think that's there. But I think what I like about Yellow Submarine versus all those things is.
Oh yeah.
I don't. It has no pretensions to being finished, even particularly. It's just this journey that you go on that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Right.
You're not even sure why it makes you feel like the way that it does. But when you're at the end, you feel like you've gone on this amazing once in a lifetime. Genuinely, like once in a lifetime. Right. It's no like, oh yeah, you know, I'll, like Pixar movies and Marvel, like or whatever. Like there's other movies out there. Like there's nothing out there before or since that's anything like. How it looks and how it feels and what it does.
Do you know the closest in terms of mood, maybe, is the Gene Wilder Willy Wonka?
Yeah, maybe. But even that, like, that's based on a... I know what you mean, but that's based on a book. In other words...
No, but meaning it goes from A to B to C to D to E. Like, there's no real through line other than we're all in the factory.
Right,
and bizarre stuff happens that is inhuman and surreal and weird and whatever. You know, every so often there's a little song, there's little asides. I just mean it's got that very loose.
No, I know what you mean. But still, like, I guess what I'm saying is that when you get to the end of it, you've been taken on this once in a lifetime trip that's made you happy, it's made you laugh, it's made you tap your feet. It's like that's all you want out of life, isn't it? Like, all you want out of entertainment, like, really, when you boil down to it, is you want to, like, laugh and feel good. And like tap your feet and sing a song and, you know, feel like maybe everything's going to be okay. And like they do that in a way that's never been done before, never been done since. Like, the way that I'm just mean the way that it looks, the way that it feels, the way it all hangs together.
Yeah.
And they had no idea what they were doing when they started it. No. And they had no idea whether, like, I'm sure when they sat there, like premiere night, whenever they came to the screen, the people who made it were like, are they going to fucking hate this? Because this is really weird. Like, right. It's weird. And yet, you know, it's amazing. And it 50 years later.
Yeah.
50 years, we're sitting in a cinema in Williamsburg.
And by the way, to remaster...
Because we couldn't get into the cinema in downtown Brooklyn because it was sold out.
Yeah.
50 years later.
Yeah.
Some silly Beatles movie they threw together without the Beatles even fucking being involved.
Music.
Anyway, I'm glad we went to see it.
Me
thank
too.
You very much. Do we have anyone to thank? Any new Patreon people?
No, fucking cheap
freeloading son of a bitch.
No new Patreon people, but I would like to say a big shout out to the lads over at Infirmary Media, also known as the Poop Culture Podcast.
Okay.
They had me on again for their Dueling Decades.
Okay.
As their judge. They have two teams of two people. They present a month from a year in the 90s and a month from a year in the 80s.
And they thought you would be an impartial judge.
And they fight it out between the two based on...
And the 80s won, because you were the judge.
No, because the 80s are genuinely better than the 90s.
Yeah, see, there you go.
Based on news story, hot product like toy or computer or whatever, music and movie. Oh, and TV. There's five different categories.
What was the movie in the 80s?
Oh, so it came down to, and I don't want to spoil it because the episode hasn't aired yet, but it came down to a duel between the Kurt Russells. Escape from New York was the 80s movie, and Tombstone was the 90s movie.
Oh, that would have been tough for you.
I'm just going to leave it out there. Tune in to the Poop Culture Podcast on their next Dueling Decades episode to find out just what happened. But they were a bloody wonderful bunch of guys. And I have a super lot of fun, so I want to give them a shout out.
Well, they deserve it, mate. And if you want to get a shout out next week, become a Patreon member like Charles H. Nelson. And what was the guy that signed up after the podcast started?
Charles H. Nelson.
Someone signed up after we talked.
Chris Leatherman,
that was it. Good, strong, noble lads, both.
Oh, did you listen to the podcast then? Yeah, when I inserted Chris Leatherman in afterwards?
Yeah. and they deserve nothing but the highest praise and the warmest blankets.
The warmest blankets.
Metaphorical and actual.
Yeah, all right.
And as for the rest of you, I hope you go cold and hungry.
I never admitted it before, but my cousin is the bluebird of happiness.
See you, young mo-
Thank you.